Fine, we're on source sheet number 10. And we are steaming ahead. We're in double digits on our 80-part extravaganza.
There are 80.
Now there's 70 to go. You guys are going to have such bakias. You're going to have such a lot of sources in your heads by the end of the year. You are going to know more about these topics than almost anybody else in the Jewish world. I'm actually not exaggerating. Okay, guys in yeshiva never get to do any of this. So you are already ahead of the pack. You just have to remember some of them, that's all. Now, we are beginning now to talk about the concepts of Masorah. Don't worry, we are not going to leave behind the Rambam's other three categories. Where did Hannah go? Okay, fine. We are not going to leave behind the Rambam's other three categories, which are droshes, and he's even going to talk a little bit about that today, and drabonons. Don't worry, we've got lots to talk about drabonons. The authority of the rabbis, how they made drabonons, how they didn't make drabonons. That's coming. But today, since we've dealt with number one and two, which are the stuff Misinai, I want to talk a little bit about the process of Masorah. Masorah, of course, means what?
Tradition.
Not really. What does it actually mean? Transmission. It's not really tradition. There isn't really a Hebrew word for tradition. Masorah limsor means to hand over. Look at source number one. You will see source number one multiple times. Moshe kibel Torah miSinai. You've seen this before, I'm sure. Moshe received the Torah from Sinai, which is an interesting way of putting it. At Sinai, from Sinai. I'm not getting into that now. Umasarah leYoshua. He handed it over. Masorah. This is the beginning of Masorah, and we'll zero in on that. We'll dwell on that in a minute. He handed it over to Yoshua. UYoshua leZakenim, and Yoshua handed it over to the Zakenim, who were the elders living at the latter part of Yeshua's life. According to some, they put in a mention here of the Shoftim, okay, who are, of course, the people that live, Gidon, Shimshon, etc., etc. The Zakenim le Nevi'im, the Zakenim gave it over to the Nevi'im, and of course we all know who the Nevi'im are, Yeshaya, Yirmiyahu, Yechezkel, and of course all the Nevi'im, the Treasar, etc., etc. And the Nevi'im handed it over to the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. Now, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah we're going to talk about more, but they, of course, lived at the beginning of the Second Temple period. There was a crossover. There was a time at which some of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah were also Nevi'im. Malachi, Zechariah, Haggai. They were the last of the Malachim, and they were also on the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, this super Sanhedrin of 120 people, 120 rabbis. The normal Sanhedrin was how many? 71. So there was a massive, at the beginning of the Second Temple period, there was a super Sanhedrin of 120 odd, because of reasons that we'll talk about when we get there. That's the reason, just as a piece of little modern history, when the Israeli government was formed, the state was formed, and they decided to form the Knesset. So they formed the Knesset out of 120 members because it was modeled on the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah from the Second Temple period. But what you see very interestingly here is that the Nevi'im are part of the chain of transmission. The question is, what did they do? And we'll see there's a very big debate about this. The Rambam is going to say at the end of the day that the Nevi'im did absolutely not use their powers of Nevuah as part of the Masorah. Because the Nevi'im were wearing, according to the Rambam, different hats. They were wearing Navi hats and also Rabbi hats. Okay? But we'll see there's a big debate about that, which is just coming up soon. So there is this process of Masorah. What are they handing down? Well, they're handing down halacha received from Sinai. We already saw that. They're handing down droshes that have been made. We haven't talked about how droshes work, but making droshes and making dinei drabonon started from day one. Moshe Rabbeinu was already doing that. So that already begins to form the corpus of Jewish law. If you've seen that very nice poster, the Sea of Halacha, you seen that poster? The Sea of Halacha, we have it in our house. When you come to our house, you look at it, it shows you this little trickle of water coming out of Sinai, building into this massive river, into this big sea. Obviously, the Torah Shabbat Pei is growing and growing and growing because more stuff is being added in through 3, 4, and 5. And that's all being transmitted as well. When I say 3, 4, and 5, you know what I mean, right? Because you can imagine on the board, you have this thing in your head, obviously. When you wake up in the morning, this is the first thing that you see. When you open your eyes and your mind is like imprinted on your mind, is that. And this basically says everything. One day, I won't need to actually even give class. I'll just stand up and draw this and you'll go, that's it. talking codes. Now, I brought you this very nice Appendix 1. Let's look at Appendix 1 for a second. This was not done by me. This was done by somebody some time ago, and it does the rounds. People see it and like it. This is one chain of Masorah. It happens to be the one that leads through me, therefore that's what I gave you. But you'll see, based on the Rambam has all these names as well. You see, starts with Moshe, it goes through Yeshua, and there's the Kedim, Pinchas, Eli, then the Nevi'im, Shmuel Hanavi, etc., etc. It goes through David HaMelech. This is again taken from the Rambam. We'll see the Rambam in a minute. All the way through all the different Nevi'im, to Ezra, to the beginning of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah. Then you have the Tanaim, who are the rabbis from the Mishnaic period. You'll remember all these terms. Okay, these are the rabbis from the time of the Mishnah.
How old would Eli, if he lived through Shmuel and Avi from Pinchas?
Why? No, Pinchas was the one that lived a long time.
Yeah, but how old is
Pinchas? Pinchas is an interesting character because Pinchas is meant to have had this extremely long life. I agree. This is, you're talking about a large span of 300 years for four people. Although the truth is, you know, you don't have to be that old. Yeshua was, how old was Yeshua when he died? 110, right? And Pinchas seems to crop up again and again. He's coming up in Shoftim as well. It's an interesting question that you're raising there. Eli lived a normal sort of length life, but Pinchas was the one that had this like massive span. What's that? What if he was two different Pinchases? Yeah, you see, on a Pshat level, you're right. On a Pshat level, when you read about Pinchas coming up in Shoftim, he doesn't actually say he was called Pinchas. Chazal identify him with Pinchas. But that's a good point. I hadn't actually thought about that, but you're 100% right. Look at the Amoraim. The Amoraim go through from the time of the Gemara. The Savoraim, we'll talk about who they are when we get there. The Gaonim, there are too many people on this list of the Gaonim in page 5, because it doesn't take 55 skips to get from the year 550 to the year 1000. That's because some of these people are actually also colleagues and not just rabbis and students. But once we hit the Rishonim, we see it split into an Ashkenazi Masorah, because I'm Ashkenazi, and therefore forgive my parochialism, but that's how I choose the Masorah that I put on the page. So it goes, of course, through Rashi, through all the Ashkenazi Rishonim, okay, all the way through to the Ramah, who you know and love, Rav Shlomo Luria, the Maharshal, who you may not know about. It gets into the Achronim. If you trace it through, if you look for a second, are you with me, Oria? If you look for a second down in number 126, that is the Vilna Gaon. Okay? Number 129, excuse me. That is the Vilna Gaon, Rabbi Eliyahu, the Gaon of Vilna. It goes through Volozhin, through the Yeshivin Volozhin, Rabbi Yitzchak Volozhiner. It goes through the Tziv, his son-in-law. It goes through to Rav Chaim Briska, Rav Boruch Belebovitz in the yeshiva world, Rav Nochem Pesovitz, and Rav Yitzchak Berkovitz, who is my teacher, okay, who I went to Kola with. It goes into me, it goes into you, it goes into the big blue yonder. Okay, whoever you teach, it goes to your children, it goes to your students. If we stand in front of a class in 15 years from now and impart your pearls of wisdom to your students, it goes to whoever it goes to. And I've written at the bottom here, I've just put a little note, it's worth reckoning that actually the generations since Sinai are only around 83. There are 140 skips on here, but you don't need that many. And I put the personal example of my great-grandmother. My great-grandmother was born in the 1890s. I knew her very well. She died when I was 26, so we had a very strong interchange of, you know, adult ideas. When my great-grandmother, we called her Bobby Janie because Bobby was, well, Bubba, we called whatever. My Bobby Janie was a little child. The old people that lived in her time knew the Vilna Gaon. Now, the Vilna Gaon was born in the 1730s. And yet, the old people that my great-grandmother knew were living at the same time as the Vilna Gaon. He died in the 1790s. Now, that's an amazing thing. So there you have just me, my great-grandmother, those old people, and you're already back to the Vilna Gaon, which is actually 300 years in only 3 skips. So this is probably a lot of skips. You probably don't even need that many. It doesn't take that long to get back to Sinai. It's not buried in some kind of prehistoric caveman, like people think of Har Sinai being tens of thousands of years ago. It's really not that long ago, and therefore that's worth bearing in mind as well. The Rambam's chain of Masorah I brought down is exactly the same, because this was based on that. He goes from Moshe to Rav Ashi, and you can read that in Appendix 2 when you like. It comes in his introduction to the Yad HaChazakah. This thing at the bottom where I put the dates was just me. I did this at the bottom of Appendix 2, so you could get a feel for the Jewish dates. we'll talk about Jewish dates. Zelopashut. At the beginning of the Second Temple period, we're missing 160 something years. And where those missing years go is a subject of great discussion.
I noticed Pinchas doesn't have any dates next to his name.
You know something that's interesting as well. Let's do a bit of research on Pinchas and see how that works. These, of course, are not the only people who had the Masorah. It wasn't just three people with a secret message, but these are the main people responsible. When he says Moshe gave it to Yeshua, of course, the whole Jewish people had the Torah, not just Yeshua. And Pinchas, the whole Jewish people had the Torah, not just Pinchas. But these were the people with responsibility, if you like. Yes, or yeah.
Well, you said Masorah, the Torah that was.
So what are we talking about in Masorah? We're talking about Torah Shabbat Heh. We're talking about the halachas that were given at Sinai and the other stuff that was developed off.
The thing is, like, it started off with Moshe and then it went down for all these generations. But every single time, like, somebody adds something.
Yes, absolutely.
It's going like
this.
So it's not the same how it started.
No.
It's not the Gemara then.
Meaning, what's at the beginning is number one and two, okay? And as you're going through, you're getting, you know, one, two, three, four, and five.
Okay,
yeah?
And
does
also,
that make sense?
Yeah. Also, how do we know that it's, like, correct in people?
Oh, that's source number two. Let's go to source number two right now.
Why was there 150 years in that?
Oh, we'll talk about that when we get that. I have a whole sheet on that. It's really fascinating. It's really fascinating. We'll talk about that. Don't worry. Tune in. It's around sheet 37.
Away.
You have to be patient, girls. You have to be patient.
Wait, is it because of something going on?
It really depends on what I put in the first semester. You're already planning your second semester classes. I see that going on. I don't know. We'll have to see. Probably. Maybe not. Number two. Tanna Rabbanan. What is the way that they transmitted the Torah? Oria, I'm glad you asked that because it leads directly into source number two. Ketzad Seder Mishnah. What is the order of the Mishnah? The Mishnah here doesn't mean the book of Mishnah. It means the Torah Shebaal Peh. How did they transmit it? So look what it says. Moshe learned from the Force. Who is the Force? God is the Force. They didn't make it up. We call God the Force thousands of years before Star Wars. Okay? Hagvura. Yeah, you think, Yeah, okay, that's one thing to remember for your shidduch. Okay, it goes really well, and then at the end you go, may the force be with you. Okay, fine. Whoa.
Yeah,
goes, yes. Okay, Nichnas Aaron. So listen, Nichnas Aaron. Aaron comes in. Look at what they do. Vashanamoy Moshe Pirkan. Moshe teaches Aaron what he learns. Okay, that's nice. Nistalek Aaron. Now Aaron goes and sits at the side. The Yashav Lishmol Moshe, and he sits to the left of Moshe. The Nichnasu Banav, and Aaron's sons come in. Vashanalehem Moshe Pirkan, and he teaches them in front of Aaron. In front of Aaron. Now Aaron's sitting there listening again, second time around. Nistaku Banav, then the sons go and sit down, Aaron's sons. By the way, where are Moshe's sons?
In somewhere.
One of the most interesting question marks, this is a Tanakhi issue, not a Halakhic issue.
Yeah,
what happened to Moshe Rabbeinu's sons? He had two of his own sons, and yet it's always Aaron's sons that are part of the Masorah. Moshe's sons don't seem to figure in the Masorah, and it's one of the most fascinating early Tanakh questions as to what happened to Moshe's sons. And his grandson, who turns up later as the priest of the temple of Micha and Pesel Micha, where Moshe Rabbeinu's grandson, a grandchild off the derech, turned literally off the derech. They find him wandering off the road. It's the first example we see of a kid who goes off and what happens to him and how that sort of psychology works. Really fascinating. Look into that some other time. Nothing to do with my course at all. I just flag it to you as something you need to learn about one day. There's a whole medrash that when Moshe went to live with Yisro, Yisro made him make a promise that the first kid that's born, Yisro is going to bring up as a pagan. And that he only allowed him to marry Tzipora on the basis of the medrash that the first kid would be influenced by. It's a whole discussion. How did Moshe agree to that? Did he agree to that? I'm not, this is off the topic, clearly, but I'm just raising it as an issue.
Well, when you have
right,
them,
right,
we just
take
our 5 years, give them the people. That's
so classic.
Right, right, right. When you have my sons go off the deck. So let's do it. If you have that kind of relationship with a Kaddish Baruch, you're not going to necessarily be the best father. You're a father to a nation.
I don't think it's for us to analyze Moshe's parenting skills, But there's no question, you're right, Hannah, that the relationship one has with an individual like Moshe Rabbeinu is not going to be a standard, normal relationship. So whatever happened, but Aaron's sons are the ones here. Now listen.
And they're also, him and his wife also sort of got divorced.
Yeah, it was a very unsatisfactory situation on many levels. Nichnasu Zikanim. The Zikanim came in. Vashalahem Moshe Pirkin, and then Moshe teaches them. So listen, Moshe's now taught it to Aaron, to his sons, to the Zakanim. Nistalku Zakanim, the Zakanim go to the side, Venichnasu Kal Ha'am, and all the people come in, Vashalahem Moshe Pirkin, and Moshe teaches them. So now, says the Medrash, this is the Medrash, Nimsu Biyad Aaron Arba, so now Aaron's heard it four times, Biyad Banav Shlosha, the sons have heard it three times, Biyad Zakanim Shnaim, the Zakanim have heard it twice, or Biyad Kol Ha'am Echad. And the people have heard it once. So now it's being repeated multiple times, but that's not the end. Nistalak Moshe, now Moshe goes to the side. Vashanahem Aaron Pirkan, and Aaron teaches it in front of his teacher. Nistalak Aaron, and Aaron goes to the side. Vashanahem Bana Pirkan, and the sons of Aaron teach it. Nistalak Banav, and the sons of Aaron go to the side. Vashanahem Zikain Pirkan, and the elders teach it. Nimsa Beyat HaKol Arba, therefore everybody learns it multiple times from multiple people. Mikan Amar Rabbi Eliezer, from this Rabbi Eliezer said, Chayav Adam Lashanos Talmidoi Arba Pa'amim. You have to repeat everything to your students four times, he says, because until you've learned it four times, you haven't learned it at all. Don't call it Chazara, don't call it I'm going over or reviewing. Until you've learned it four times, you haven't learned it. Review starts from five onwards. This is an important thing to know. One of the most important segulas, it's not a segula because there's nothing magical in it, one of the most important methodologies in remembering your learning is to do chazara. And this people find very hard to do, and girls for sure are not used to this. The idea of going stuff over stuff again and again and again and again and again. And yes, it's boring. Yes, it is boring, but it's the only way to get it into your head, because boring bores it into your head. Okay? Different word, but similar sound. And therefore, what you've got here from a Torah perspective, just one second, Michal, is an important point which I'm making now. How do we know that we're not playing broken telephone, or if you're English, Chinese whispers? Meaning, I play a game, I'm going to start with Sarah, I'm going to whisper something in her ear, I'm going to whisper a little message, and I'm going to whisper a message that says, I like Venice in April. Okay? And she's going to whisper to Itai, and Itai's going to whisper to her, Itai's going to whisper to her, everyone's going to whisper to everybody, until eventually Oria, who is the last one in the chain, we say to Oria, what's the message, Oria? And she says, my feet smell in the morning. And everybody laughs, because it's funny, but it's really not funny, it's a stupid game, unless you're 5 years old, or you've had loads of vodka, or something, I don't know, okay, I don't know, and then everyone laughs at everything. Okay, fine, but you wouldn't know about that, because you're not allowed that. Now listen, I'm going to get to you, Michal, don't worry. Yeah, exactly. I'm glad someone asked that, Shaila. Okay, listen. What's going on here is as follows. The Midrash is addressing the direct question of broken telephone, meaning, how do we know we're not playing broken telephone with Torah? How do we know we're not whispering a secret message? Well, I'll tell you, just one second. First of all, we are saying multiple repetitions of the same information. Let's play telephone, but it's changed the rules. I don't whisper it to Sarah, I scream it at her, and she screams it back at me, and we scream at each other for 15 minutes until I'm absolutely sure she's got the message. And then she screams at the attire, and then everyone screams at everybody until eventually Oria gets the message and screams it back at me. And I say to the crowd, if Oria gets exactly the right message, everybody in the room gets $20,000. Now, we're not going to play broken telephone the same way anymore. She's going to get the message right for sure. Number one. So, number one, the transmission method of Torah is the opposite of broken telephone. Number two, don't think that, well, we didn't put this on the sheet yet, but what we're transmitting is not a secret code. It's not specific words, and we'll see later how this works. In fact, you already saw this. You already saw this in the earlier sheet, right? The idea that Torah Shebaal Peh in its original form was ideas, holy ideas, not holy words. Remember that? That's what oral Torah is. Meaning, when I'm transmitting to Sarah, I'm not just transmitting a 5 million digit binary message that she has to get exactly right, otherwise we mess up the Torah. It's not about the words, it's about the ideas. Meaning, I sit with Sarah for a year, for 2 years, for 3 years, and I say to her, let's learn together until I'm sure that you get it. How do you know when you're having a conversation with someone that they really got it? That they... Yeah, and you kind of get this feeling, yeah, right. Your words are different from my words, but I can see you get it. You get it. Now you can transmit it to the next generation. That's what's going on. It's so the opposite of telephone. It's so the opposite of Chinese whispers. Don't ask me why we call it that in England. We do. Okay? It's so the opposite of that for multiple reasons. It's repeated. The implications are very strong to get it right. The incentive to get it right. And also, it's not just a string of words. It's ideas. Very important distinctions. Mikhail, you had a question? And Hannah had a question. No, because they're learning it, because Har Sinai, they didn't learn anything at Har Sinai. The Bnei Israel stood at Har Sinai, listened to God speak, and then immediately, on the Midrashic level, whatever, died. I mean, they couldn't cope with that. But Har Sinai was not about learning Torah at all. Moshe Rabbeinu was, because Moshe Rabbeinu doesn't function like anybody else. We'll see in a minute. For the Bnei Israel, Har Sinai was about one thing and one thing only, which is getting a clear relationship with God, which they are left in no doubt at all that they've just met with the Divine Presence. They didn't actually learn anything.
Whenever they were taught the Torah, it says that they only learned it once, but why didn't they learn it?
No, they didn't learn it once. Moshe taught it, and then they heard Aaron teach it, then they heard the Bnei Aaron teach it, then they heard the Zakadian teach it. Everybody's hearing it multiple times. And that's how it works. That's what... What does it mean, v'shinan tam levanecha? You'll repeat it to your children. Chazal had an interesting drash. What is shinaim?
Teeth.
So, v'shinan tam levanecha, Chazal say, is you'll give it over to your children so that it makes an impression on them. So that, like, when you bite into something and you take your teeth off, the impression is still there. Meaning, whatever you do, the way, obviously you don't want me to bite your kids, but in terms of your knowledge, you leave something which leaves an impression on them in that way. Which is actually a very beautiful idea, the idea that when you teach your kids and you come back from them, there's something still very much left there. And that's what the whole concept of Shinun is repetition. Fine. Now, let's go on. So how did this happen at the end of Moshe's life? Let's just look a little bit, zero in on that. We see in Dvarim, at the beginning of Dvarim number 3, Be'eva Yardim Eretz Moav Hoel Moshe, Moshe begins Be'er Es HaTorah Hazot. What's Be'er mean? To explain, to clarify this Torah as follows. And the Rambam kicks in 4 and 5. We'll read this very quickly, and then we'll get into the Nevuah issues. Behiba Sofar Baim Shana. It was at the end of the 40th year. Barosh Chodesh Shvat. He kila and he gathers them together. Alav Hashalom v'amalim says to them, Hine karav zot is a man of moiti. I'm going to die soon. L'chein mishu shamim men shmur shechacha. Someone who heard something, forgot it, whatever it is. Yavav v'yishav v'yavred Allah. And you come and ask me now. Now is your last moment. Meaning, Moshe Rabbeinu is online. He's online. He has a link to God, which is different from everybody else, which we'll go into in a few minutes. And he's saying to them, this is your last chance. From now on, you will have something called Masorah. At the moment, it's not yet Masorah because it's coming direct from God. From this minute onward, from the minute he dies, it's coming through humans. There is no more way, any more way of getting through to God, unless you can do it through Nevuah, which we'll see whether you can or can't. Fine. Mishin is tapka lo sheila. Anyone has a question, doubt, or a misunderstanding, Yavova Avrenel. I'm going to explain it to them. Fine. Amar Kosas, and it says, Hoyel Moshe be'eres ha-Torah hazois le'mor. V'kacham u'chachamim b'sifrei. The chachamim say in the sifrei. What's the sifrei? The halachic medrash on Dvorim. Okay, on Bamidbar and Dvorim. Did you get what I just said? What's a halachic medrash? Yes. In other words, medrash comes in two flavors. Strawberry and vanilla. Okay, Medrash comes in two flavors, halachic and agadic. Halachic Medrash goes through the psukim, bringing down halachic derivations. Okay, we'll look at halachic Medrash, how this works. What you and I call Medrash, Midrashim, is really agadic Medrash. You really should call them agadata, not Medrash, because the word Medrash means both, halachic and agadic. So fine, so we'll see here. So he says in the Sifrei, Kol sheshachach halacha achas yavo v'yishena v'yishna, kol sheyesh leperish yavo v'yishna. The imtu bipi hashmua, okay. The lamdu hapirushim. They learned all the explanations, number one and number two, etc. Like we said, the meshech oisa hazman shemish rosh chodesh shvat ad shiv'a ba'adar. From the first of Shvat to the seventh of Adar, they learned everything that Moshe had learned from God. Ukaashe haya lifnei Moshe. When it came time for him to die, nigash liksiva, he put it down into writing and he wrote down the Torah shebichtav. Moshe wrote down the Chumash. The Katav Shlosha Asar Sefer Torah. He wrote 13 Sefer Torahs, Gvilim, on cloth, on parchment. Kulam, Mibes Reshis. Mibes Breishis, from the base of Breishis, Ad Lamed Yisrael, to the Lamed of Yisrael, meaning he paskins that Moshe writes it at the O to the end, and he paskins he wrote the last eight psukim as well. But Nasan Sefer, Lekol Shevet Lelechet B'drachav, and he gave a Sefer Torah to each Shevet to go and develop their own special flavor of Torah, Reuven Torah, Shimon Torah, Levi Torah, Yehuda Torah, etc., all based on the Sefer Torah. The Amalem, and he said to them, Lekoch has a Sefer Torah, and he quotes the Pesukim, etc. And then, on the 7th of Adar, at midday, so then he goes up the mountain, and he goes and he dies, except he doesn't really die, because from our perspective he's dead, but from his perspective, he's just moved on to connect with the source, okay, which is Olam Haba, etc., etc. Fine. Now, what I'm really interested in is the next bit, which talks about the process of Masorah. So have a look, please, in number 5. Because this I want to look at more carefully. Yes? The Halakhic Major just explains this process, exactly, that he wrote the Sifrei Torah, and that he taught it to the people. This whole, if you like, historical end of life process for Moshe is set out there in the Halakhic Major Shon Torah. Okay, fine. Now, number 5. Uka'asha Meis. And once he had died, and now everything changes, the world has changed, because there's no longer a Moshe Rabbeinu to connect with God. Alav HaShalom. Who kfar masar, here's this word, masorah. He'd already handed on to Yeshua Mashe Nitin Loi Min HaPerush, what he'd given in column number 1 and 2. V'hitzbonen bo Yeshua, and Yeshua was mitzbonen. What's mitzbonen?
Learning.
Learning, teaching, learning it. V'anshei Doro, and all the people in his generation. So it's not just him. The Chalma Shekibah Mimenu Hu'a Echad HaZekeinim, anything that Yeshua, the Zekeinim, got from Moshe, Ein Bo Dinu Dvarim, there's no debate about. V'loi Nachla Bo Machloikis, there's no Machloikis, we talked all about that, not getting into that again. U'Mashe Loi Shama Boy, what he didn't hear from Moshe, okay, Davar Min HaNavi, Alav HaShalom, what he didn't hear from Moshe Rabbeinu, Min HaNafim, the details of Halacha, Haitzi HaDin Bo BeHekish, they could learn out through the 13 Midas. Meaning, not just these 13, but many of them, they could learn these new halachas from the Chumash that Moshe had not yet learned. B'chukim ha-shlosh ha-tzah, with the using these 13 middas, ha-natunelo b'sinai, which were given on Sinai. Again, we haven't really talked about how drash works yet, but we will. Hein shlosh ha-shrei, middas sh'atar nidrashi b'hem. Fine. U'mi oysan ha-dinim sh'hoiti, on these other dinim, which also form part of the Masorah, but they're coming afterwards. They're not coming from Moshe. Necessarily. Dvarim shalai nafla behem achlokis, if everyone agreed on them, then shkoyach, very nice. That's good. Elahaita alehim askoma, but there was an agreement, then that's very nice. Umehem and other ones, mashin nafla bo machlokis, there was machlokis be shnei svaras, between two different opinions. The hikish zeh hekesh, this one learnt it out from the midois, the nitchazek etzloi, and he stuck to his guns. The hikish zeh hekesh, and the other one learnt it out, vinitchazek etzloi. Ki hamidois ha-vikuchiyot. What's vikuchiyot? What's vikuach? Yes, because midot, which are argumentative, they lead to argument. Yikra behekeshehem ha-mikra hazeh. This happens a lot. Why do people disagree? And Rambam here is giving us our first flavor of why there is machlokas, which we're going to look at in detail. But we're having our first flavor here is one of the key reasons for machlokas is people just don't see things the same way. And that's good. Why should I think the same way as Arya? She has a different brain. She has her opinion. I have my opinion. Now, obviously, we have to both understand what we're talking about. If we're not qualified, we can't express a qualified opinion. But once we are qualified, she can express an opinion, I can express an opinion. I told you we make a bracha on 600,000 Jews. I mentioned this. Did I mention this?
No.
You make a bracha when you see 600,000 Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what's the bracha? Have you ever seen 600,000 Jews together?
There was recently.
Recently, the first time in about 2,000 years, when there was nothing like 600,000 Jews. When Rav Avi Yosef, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, died last November, there were 750,000 Jews at the Levaya. So I went to the Levaya to see 600,000 Jews, and of course I saw two Jews. One like this, and one like this, in front of my face. So I saw like I just saw a black jacket walking in front of me. That's all I saw for 2 hours. Okay? So If I'd have been in a helicopter, my son actually ran up a building. He's got more seichel than me. He wanted to see the people. So he ran up to the top of, you know, there's buildings all around in Romema where they were walking through to the funeral. So he everyone's running. So he ran also. They all ran onto the roof of a building. There's like thousands of these guys crowded on the roof of the building. So he said to me, then this guy downstairs starts from screaming and shouting and runs up onto the roof and said, my building's collapsing. It's my roof. And the walls are cracking inside his building because there are like 10,000 guys. Yeah. So he says, everybody get off the roof, quick, you know, and so then we all ran down the stairs again, like, nuts. So, had I had a helicopter, and I'd have flown up and see, I'd have said a bracha. What bracha would I have said? Baruch atah Hashem, Elokeinu melech ha'olam, Chacham ha'razim. It's worthwhile remembering that. You might not have an art school sitting with you when you need to say it. Chacham ha'razim. The wise knower of all secrets. The God knows all secrets. Why? So the Gemara in Brachas explains, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we'll see the source inside later on. HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees into everybody's minds and knows everybody's thoughts. And just like every one of them has a different face, no two people have the same face, so no two people have the same minds. And isn't that amazing that all the different people have different minds, and yet God can see them all? Meaning we make a bracha on the fact that every Jew has a different opinion.
About what you say to
non-Jews
too, because
for sure they also have minds. They also have different opinions.
But okay? How can you tell someone else about like their opinion? Like, how can you have motivated
about their first of all, no one's telling everybody off.
No,
but you
people get very like let's
say, oh, so first of all, never confuse people getting excited with people getting upset. Meaning, the way when it comes to understanding, we don't just kind of talk over a cup of tea and say, that's an interesting idea. Like, I never thought of it that way. How lovely. Like, I went to an Israeli yeshiva, okay? I sat for years sitting next to these big Israeli guys screaming at each other. Israeli Haredi yeshiva, and at one point I was sitting on, we hadn't tables, we were just sitting on benches with shtenders, okay? And they crammed as many people into this building as they could. It was a great yeshiva, but I was on this bench next to this, he was a big guy, okay? And standing there's Israeli guy, and he screamed all day long. My chavrusa was actually very quiet. He was a South African guy, very gentle, you know, you know, that kind of thing. But this guy next to me was nuts. So I said, at one point I plucked up the courage and said to him in Hebrew, like, you know, I tapped him on the shoulder and said to him, do you need to scream so much? So he turned around to me and his eyes went like this. You know, he just turned around to me and he screamed in my face. Like, if I'd have had hair, it would have gone like this. Yeah? I had a bit more then. He screamed in my face. He said, mitzvah d'oraisa. Mitzvah d'oraisa. Mitzvah d'oraisa to scream. Meaning, this is Torah. You know, if the Torah and my brain don't connect, something's terrible going on, because this is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and this is from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and if they don't agree with each other, then that's something I have to scream about. So
we don't agree with you, and you don't agree with someone else.
In other words, we get excited about the fact that we have an opinion. It doesn't mean we delegitimize other people's opinions. Now, some people be, and that's a problem. That's called Sinat Chinam. Sinat Chinam is when I delegitimize somebody because of their opinion. That's when Machlokas turns into Sinat Chinam. And I agree, and that's why the Second Temple was destroyed. Sinat Chinam, people say it means baseless hatred. But you know, Chana, nobody ever hates anyone for no reason.
Yeah.
No one ever walked up to me in the street and said to me, I hate you. Why? No reason. Okay? No reason.
Like, they can hate someone for seemingly baseless
hatred. Sinat Chinam means, and we're not going to see this because it's not part of today's course, or this year's course, whatever. Sinat Chinam means when I take a machloket with someone about an issue, and I turn it into a machloket about a personality. That's a problem. That's a major problem. And says the Netziv in his very famous Hakdamas of Rashis, okay, he says that even though the people in the Bais Sheni were all tzaddikim, they were chassidim, they were goyim lechassadim, they were l'shem shamayim, they were all destroyed because they called each other apikoiris and heretic and this and that and the other. And he says God has got no time for such people, even if they're l'shem shamayim. It doesn't help if they're l'shem shamayim. Everyone's l'shem shamayim. I'm doing it for the sake of heaven. No, but you're delegitimizing another person. You can't do that. You can disagree with them. You can scream in their face. As long as they understand what's going on. It's a cultural issue. You know, British people don't like that. You know, it's an issue. When I first went to an American yeshiva, I was with Americans. Like, so Israelis scream, okay? So I had to get used to that. Then I had to get used to Americans. What Americans do, they touch you all the time. Okay? And I tell you something. Now I'm used to it. But guys coming up to me in Yeshiva, like, you know, this, like, I need my personal space. Like,
Americans are like that anyway.
I'm telling you, it took a long time to get used to this idea. Look, I'm English. We barely touch our wives and children. Unless we really have to. Okay? So some complete stranger wants to come and give me a massage. Like, no. So now I'm used to it. So now I'm multicultural. Now I can live with Israelis and get screamed at. I can live with Americans and get massaged. And it's like, I'm good with everything now. Yes. On track.
Does that, like, the whole thing about illegitimizing other Palestinians, like, are you talking specifically within Torah Machloket, or like,
we'll talk about
like, because if I disagree with the Christian view of God, like,
not everybody has a legitimate opinion.
Exactly.
Fine. So we'll deal with that. Let's talk about that when we talk about Machlokas. We have three sheets. We have three sheets about Machlokas. We'll get there when we get there. Ladies, let's finish number five. So fine. So where there's a Machlokas, we go according to the majority. Very nice. And now we have a way forward. Look at the last two lines of the Rambam in number five. Veda. And you should know, he says, Nevuah won't help you. And this already is now going to be a controversial question. How much could they use Nevuah? The Rambam Shita, we'll see this as the next sheet, is that very strongly they could not use Nevuah in order to answer halachic questions. Ubahoitzaha anafim, deriving these details through the Shlosh Esrei Midos, which we're going to talk about, that doesn't help to use Nevuah. Elamashi yasu Yeshua v'Pinchas, that which Yeshua and Pinchas did, be'inyan ha'iyun v'hafekesh, when it came to analysis. That's exactly the same as Ravina and Ravashi did. When did Ravina and Ravashi live? Already in the time of the Gemara, 1,500 years later. In other words, he says, when Yeshua and Pinchas are arguing in Halacha, they're not throwing Nevuahs at each other. Like, you know, sort of spells almost, like, you know, whatever, Expelliarmus or whatever it is. They're not doing that, Lahavdil. They are analyzing in an analytical, logical way. And they're not allowed, says the Rambam, to use a Nevuah, because that's no longer the method that Torah is allowed to be learned. Now we'll see that not everybody agrees with the Rambam, and some people feel very strongly that in the early days in Beis Rishon, there was Nevuah, and Nevuah was critical, and this is going to really affect the way that we understand Halacha in the time of the First Temple, which is what we're going to start talking about now. Yes?
But why would you waste that? Like it's like, even like you get the source sheet, and then like you think of the source, you don't understand it. So we could either like puzzle over it and maybe get it wrong, or we could ask you know the answer,
right,
and we'll have it right. Like, why are they?
Because the answer is, we're not trying to get it right. We are trying to get it right. We're certainly trying to get it right, but turning to HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Nevuah in order to get the answer is sidestepping the whole system in a way that actually breaks down the system. Because how do I know who's speaking to God? Okay, in those days they were real Nevi'im. We could test them out and we could check they were real. But every time somebody comes out of a cave and says, I spoke to God, that's going to be the way that I answer a Shaila. Fine, we'll see, we'll talk about this. The Rambam takes the view against you. We'll see that the Meiri and Tosfos take more like your view. And we'll talk about that next time.
Then you have the whole situation of Tony Amaga, and that's why they were so angry.
Tony Amaga was not a Navi.
No, I'm saying no, but like that was like, right. But like that, the way that I always learned that story was that was the beginning of the breakdown of the preparation for when there was no connection to God. And that's years and years.
No, yeah, I don't think so. Chaim Amago was way after Nevuah finished. He had a connection through Tefillah, whatever. He had a special Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh they did have. But we'll see the source that says when Rabbi Shua and Rabbi Lezer are arguing and Rabbi Lezer brings a baskol. We'll talk about Ruach HaKodesh, what exactly is the difference in Nevuah. When Rabbi Lezer brings a baskol out from Shemaim to answer the halachas like him, Rabbi Yeshua says, I'm not listening. Not listening. We'll get there. Okay, fine. Yes, two questions then we must do the last 20 minutes. Yes, Mikhail. Fine, yes. Ah, good. So, well, the Urim and Tumim may be a different thing. And it may be that Urim and Tumim is not dealing with halachic issues. The Urim and Tumim on the breastplate, the Kohen Gadol.
No,
meaning, Nevuah, the Urim and Tumim work through Nevuah as well, for sure. Nevuah was definitely used for factual questions. What's the first question that we see that they're asking a Navi in Nach? No, before that, even. Or well, they're not asking, Yeshua was a Navi, but they didn't come and ask him about that. What's Shaul going to ask Shmuel HaNavi? And he says, there's a Navi we need to ask him. He says, he's going to ask him, where are my lost donkeys? Okay? Factual questions. We'll deal with this next time, Jessica. That's really next week's sheet. For now, let's just focus on the fact that the Rambam says that Nevuah is out. And therefore, the Rambam is supported, and we'll see how the other people learn these sources, by 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11, who all seem to say that something radical changed when Moshe Rabbeinu died, and Nevuah is now off the menu. Yes? He wasn't stupid. He needed to find his lost donkeys. He wasn't stupid at all. He was nervous. He was nervous because he's going to bother the God of Hador about his lost donkeys.
But
no, he's a young man. He's nervous. Everyone will be nervous. On the other hand, his father's going to kill him because he's lost the donkeys. Eventually he goes and asks them, and Shmuel doesn't say to him, it's a stupid question. He says to him, it's a fine question. Your donkeys are okay, and by the way, you're going to be the Melech Israel. Good job you came. Okay? So beware what you ask in Navi, because you might get more than you bargained for. But it's not a stupid question. He was just nervous. Everybody's nervous in that episode. You look at the girls when they speak to Shaul. You read that?
Yeah.
When the girls are speaking to Shaul and they're speaking in the giggly, or they're all giggling with him, and the way that the Psukim says that they're all like nervous teenage girls. It's really interesting. Read the Psukim there. Number 6. Let's look at these Nevuahs, these issues. Comes along and says like this. V'diber Hashem el Moshe panim el panim. God spoke to Moshe panim el panim. What does it mean, panim el panim? What does that mean? Because when I speak to you, what does it mean face to face? It was without any mechitzas, without any veil, without, of course, Moshe Rabbeinu had light emanating from his face, and when he came down from the mountain, says the Psukim, not the Midrashim, Psukim, he had to put a veil over his face when he came out of the Ohel Moed. So when he spoke to God, he was panim el panim, kashi yidabe yishol riyahu, says the Pasuk, just like I speak to Esther. Okay?
Well, Moshe glowed?
He did. Not just in the night, but also by day. Okay? So what does it mean, panim el panim?
He really looks like the sun.
So let's have a look now. So then Moshe died. Yeshua takes over. Look at number 7. But he achrei mos Moshe. Then Moshe has died. Eved Hashem. This is the beginning of Yeshua. This is the Haftorah for Simchas Torah. Okay? But Yomeh Hashem el Yehoshua bin Nun. God says to Yeshua bin Nun, Masharis Moshe Leimos. So was Yeshua a Novi?
Yeah.
You betcha. Of course he was a Novi. God speaks to him directly. God speaks to Yeshua. And he says, Lo Yomoshe Ba'atariah Zemipicha, the Sefer Torah must never leave your mouth, for he gives about Yomam Ba'yalayla, you have to study it day and night, etc., etc. Lema'an Tishmol Asos Kecholat Kasav, Boy Ki Az Tatzliach Ez Darkecha Ba'az Taskin. He tells him he has to learn Torah. But Yeshua's learning of Torah was radically different from Moshe Rabbeinu's. And I brought you in the appendix. Let's first of all look at source number 8. But in source number 8, we see the famous statement in Yevamos, Kol HaNeviim Nistaklu Ba'Aspeklaria She'einu Me'ira. All the Neviim looked, Nistaklu, they stared, they perceived through Aspeklaria. What's an Aspeklaria? A glass or a lens, which was Einu Me'ira. Not clear, frosted glass, meaning, like I showed you on the board before, Koi Amar Hashem. What does that mean? We talked about this, right? Yes, it's like something like this. It's a picture, it's an image, it's an idea, it's an imaginatory, if that's the word, process. Imaginative process. Meaning that there's not this sense of absolute crystal clarity coming down. That's an aspeklaria she'einu me'ira. Imagine looking at someone's like bathroom glass. You can see figures and shadows, but you can't see it clear. But Moshe Rabbeinu nistak of aspeklaria ha'me'ira. Moshe looked through an aspeklaria me'ira, meaning he saw HaKadosh Baruch Hu not just through Koyamar Hashem, but also Zehadavar. Zehadavar is very much more specific. We saw the door of V when he talks about that. And that's why in the appendix, which I'm not going to read now, but the appendix in appendix 3, when I brought you all these different differences, four major differences, you saw this between Moshe and other Nevi'im. Moshe had prophecy when he was awake, not when he was sleeping at night. He had it in full control of his senses. He could have it at any time, anywhere. He had it without any kind of intermediary. He had it direct, panim el panim. Peh el peh, it also says with Moshe. God speaks to Moshe, peh el peh. What does peh el peh mean?
Mouth
to mouth. That's an incredible way of speaking to somebody. It's almost like a USB key going into a, like this. That's what it really means. God and Moshe, if you like, are bonding in this way, that there's an information transfer which is unlike anything else. After Moshe dies, that's gone. That's just gone. There isn't anything like that anymore. The Abarab Banel on source number, on Appendix 3 said it's because Moshe, is everything is coming through his intellectual brain as opposed to his imaginative brain, which is what the other Nevi'im are processing through. So once Moshe's gone, they can't do that anymore. And look at these really interesting sources in 9, 10, and 11. Says in Bava Basra, V'natata mehoitcha alav, give from your glory to him. But like kol hoitcha, not all of your glory. So it says, V'kenim sheva oita ador amru, when the Zekenim saw Yeshua, they said, no, pnei Moshe k'pnei chama. Moshe glows. Moshe is a source of light. Pnei Yeshua k'nei levana. Yeshua is like the moon. Oila ka'is ba'isha busha. Oila la'isha klima. What a disgrace. What an awful thing to happen. The level, the dropping of the Madrega from Yeshua, from Moshe to Yeshua. And what's interesting is the people don't seem prepared for that. Look at 10 and 11 quickly. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. B'shash nifta Moshe Rabbeinu legan Eidim. When Moshe died, says the Gemara, Amalo Yeshua, he says to Yeshua, Sha'al, now, this is your last moment. Sha'al mimeni kol sveika sheyesh lecha. We saw this in the Rambam, this is where he gets it from. Ask me whatever you need to ask. Amalo, he said to him, Rebbe, klum hanichticha, hanichticha sha'achas, have I left you for a minute? V'halachti lemachav acher, have I wasted my time? Didn't you write about me, O Masharsa, Yeshua bin Nun, Nar lo yomish mitoicha oihel? I never left your tent. In other words, how could I have any questions? I've been with you for 40 years as your right hand man. Now that's not the right answer. There must have been something. In the last few, imagine you could get 10 minutes with Moshe Rabbeinu. Like, these are the last 10 minutes of his life. You have nothing to ask him? So then he dies. Says the Gemara, Miyad, immediately after he dies, Tashash Kocha Shal Yeshua, when Yeshua gets weak, he feels this sense of, like, voltage sort of going down. Nishtachu mimenu shalosh mimeyos halachas. He forgets 300 halachas. V'nodu lo sheva meyos sveikas. He gets 700 questions. These numbers are symbolic numbers, by the way. 300, 700. V'amdu kol Yisrael hargon. The Jews don't want to kill him. Why do they want to kill him? Because he's just not up to what Moshe Rabbeinu did. So Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Moshe Rabbeinu says to him, lo melacha I efsha. I can't give you the answers. Why not? What would the Rambam say? Why not? Because I'm not allowed to give you as a Navi. I'm sorry. So what do you have to do? Lech v'tardu b'milchama. Now what does that mean? Go to war. What's the purpose of saying go to war? What, to distract them? So that they won't, they'll have something else, someone else to kill instead of him? To prove that he's a good leader. So some of the Meforshim, I don't remember where I saw this, but they say he's referring to the Milchamta Shel Torah. What's the Milchamta Shel Torah? It's my friend screaming at me in the Bet Midrash. Meaning he's saying to Yeshua, you can't learn these answers to these thousand questions through Nevuah, but I'll tell you what you can do. What can you do? You can use your thumbs. You can learn, you can analyze, you can think, you can argue. Milchama is the way that you now learn. The Milchama of Torah, there was a beautiful program done by the BBC about a year or two ago about sounds of religion. And if you had to encapsulate a sound of a religion, what would you do? This is their opening sequence. So if I had to say, what is the sound of Islam, what would you say? It's the imam from the Muzayin. Speaking from the the minarets, exactly. What's the sound of Christianity?
Church bells.
What's the sound of, like, Buddhism?
Gong.
Gong. So, yeah, what's the sound of Judaism? So you know what he did? He took his recording device into the Mir Yeshiva, and he recorded 25,000 people, however many it is, screaming at each other. And he played it back and he said, this is the sound of Judaism. It was inspired. It was incredible. This is the sound of Judaism. Of people arguing with each other. That's the sound of Judaism. We don't have bells, we don't have gongs, we don't have people screaming over minarets.
You know, it's done a shofar.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because if you'd have done a shofar, I don't think that's the sound of Judaism. That's a special sound of, you know, Rosh Hashanah, whatever. So he said you can go to Milchama, but you can't have it through Nevuah. Yes?
That doesn't really apply to everybody. Meaning, like, that can't encompass all of Judaism.
Why not? Everybody's chayav in Talmud Torah to some degree.
We don't all yell at each other. To some degree, first of all, to some degree.
Okay.
Also, some people aren't on a level to be learning the whole time. It's much easier to...
Who said the whole time? Every... I'm not, without getting into a whole discussion about women's Talmud Torah, which I'm not getting into now, every Jewish person is required to have a relationship with learning. Okay? Certainly women today, maybe they weren't 100 years ago, but always men. Meaning, in other civilizations, cultures, religions, some people were clever, they were the priests, they did baby, and the most people were kind of amoratsim. In the Jewish religion, everybody has to try and be a Talmud Chacham. Now,
why isn't there more of an emphasis on the actual practicing than halacha, which
it's both
doing?
Talmud and Maisi. You know the whole Gemara discussion there, which is more important, learning or practice? And you know it comes to a very unclear solution, which is learning is more important because it leads you to practice. So what's more important? Yeah, it's a big discussion. But everybody has to learn. That is the one common theme in Judaism. It's learning is a religious experience. It's the religious experience. That's what we're into in MMY, you know, growth through learning. Okay, I'm getting ready for my pitch after Sukkot when I go recruiting. Now, look at number 11. I've got 10 minutes and I need them. Shloisha alafim halachas nishtach b'me'ad lo sol Moshe. The same kind of idea. 3,000 halachas lost in when Moshe died and they were doing avedus for Moshe. Arula Yeshua shal. The people said to Yeshua, why don't you go and ask? Now, what do you see here? The people aren't prepared to accept Yeshua is different from Moshe. He said to them, ask God. Amalu, he said to them, Loi b'shamayim hi. I'm sorry, I can't. Amaloi l'shmul. 300 years later, they're still saying, listen carefully, Shandy, you can't miss this. 300 years later, they're still saying to Shmuel, Shaal, you go and ask God. Amalahim, he said to them, Eila mitzvahs. No, Eila mitzvahs means we've given the mitzvahs. She'ena novi rishal l'chadish dava me'ata. I can't tell you now a new thing through Nevuah. So, what's interesting here is that the people aren't prepared to accept that. They want a Moshe Rabbeinu. Why is it nice to have a Moshe Rabbeinu?
Perfect.
Spoon feeding. Wonderful. Why should I have to break my head on 15 years in the new yeshiva when I can just ask somebody and they'll tell me what to do? So we'll talk about that. What seems to, Rav Tzadok HaKohen, we'll see his thesis here, seems to be saying that the Jewish people took a long time to realize that actually what God wants from them now is not just to receive and do what they're told, but to actually engage in the process of learning.
Well, that was the entire warning about you can get it wrong.
Yes, so we'll talk about that. Maybe it's better to try and get it wrong than to just listen and get it right. We'll talk about how that works. But we're not finished yet, and I need to do one last thing. And I want to tell you what this last appendix is, because it's very important. Just leave source 12 for a second, because that's more of the same. And look at the last appendix. This is a very handy little sheet, which we'll go back to. This I got when I went to a shir in the Gush many years ago, in the Yemei Yom HaTanach. I've given you I've told you who it's by there. He made a list of... Let's look at the first temple period. Let's look at the Tanakh. You know, Rabbi Lerner has a whole course, right? Ba'ayot hilchatiyot ba'tanach. Meaning problematic issues in Tanakh. Which is very interesting. Meaning there's a lot of things in Tanakh. Well, not a lot. There are a few things in Tanakh that just don't seem to work with halacha. How does that work? And what Dr. Barzilai has done here, which is very, very helpful, is he's got five categories. Some of you found it a bit hard to understand what's going on here. Let me explain these five categories. He's taken examples. There's hundreds of references to Tanakh here. It's an amazing overview of Tanakh, of where there are certain halachas, yes in Tanakh, not in Tanakh. For example, I'm not going to go through them all, but section Aleph here is where he says explicit references in Tanakh to where they're keeping halacha because that's in the Torah. And he gives in a few examples where they explicitly talk about keeping halacha from the Torah. Yeshua building the Mizbachot that they told to build Har Avon Har Grizim. He talks about Kibush Haaretz here. He talks about in Malachim. About not killing the children for the sins of the fathers, and it says Ta'ash the Kakatub Sefer Torah Moshe. In other words, there are places in Tanakh where we see explicitly they're keeping halakha with direct reference to Tanakh. Okay, Bet is mitzvahs which are mentioned a little bit in Tanakh, okay, or they just mention with a connection or without a connection. These are mitzvahs which come up in Tanakh, Brit Milah, Shabbat. Although very interestingly, only once is Shabbat mentioned in all of Nevi'im Rishonim, but it's mentioned in many times in Nevi'im Achronim. Rosh Chodesh, Pesach, Sukkot, it says that they kept, okay, although it says that they didn't keep it from Yeshua ben Nun until the beginning of the Second Temple, which is a good question, what does that mean? It talks about different kinds of superstition, Tumah and Tara, maybe even Hilchas Nida. They're referred to. In other words, there's lots of examples in Tanakh where they were keeping halachot that seem to fit with the Torah. But if you go over the page, there are other examples the opposite way. Gimel, a mitzvot that are mentioned agav without any connection to the Torah. It doesn't say they kept them because of X. But you see Megillat Rutz, Leket, Shichra, Peah, that kind of thing. But then Dalad, you see that there are certain examples where people, you would have expected it to mention a mitzvah in the Torah, but it doesn't mention it. The third one where mitzvot are mentioned in Tanakh, but it doesn't specifically connect them with the Torah. Okay? Dalad is where people do things or there are dates or places or things mentioned that you would expect there to mention the Mishnah. It talks about Rosh Hashanah, but it doesn't mention it was Rosh Hashanah. It talks about them appointing a king, but it doesn't refer back to them. In Tanakh, it talks about the 1st of Tishrei, and nobody mentioned it's Rosh Hashanah. It talks about the 10th of Tishrei, it talks about Shlomo HaMelech dedicating the temple, but it doesn't mention that there's Yom Kippur. It talks about people having Tzara'at, but it doesn't mention the halachas of Tzara'at. It talks about David and Bathsheba, okay, but it doesn't mention specifically the issue of adultery. And then in Hay, that's more like Rabbi Lerner's course, where there are some things that people do which seem to be the opposite of the halacha, which needs to be understood. People who are eating food that doesn't seem to be kosher, people who are Ruth, the Moabite woman, marrying into, although we talked about that last time. In other words, understanding how halacha worked in the first temple is not a straightforward business. There are some parts of Tanakh that seem to work very strongly with the Torah and halacha. There are some parts of Tanakh that seem to, you'd have thought they'd have mentioned it, but they never mentioned it. There are other parts of Tanakh that raise halachic problems, which the Gemara usually picks up and answers and says, well, it's because of this and this, because of that and that, and you see the halacha works. But ultimately, we don't fully understand exactly how halacha worked in the time of the first temple period. Because the halachic systems that we know and love, all the halachic categories that we learn about, really only got going fully at the beginning of the second temple. It's clear they kept Torah in the first temple. By the way, one of the ways that they archaeologically can tell the difference between a Jewish discovery and a non-Jewish discovery, they can be just two hills apart, but a Jewish fortress has no pig bones in it, and a Philistine, a Plishti fortress, is full of pig bones from what they were eating. So it's clear that people are keeping mitzvot, but exactly how they did that and the details is less clear. Once you start looking at the second temple, it starts to look much more like the halachic system that you and I have today. What we have as the halachic system is very old, and it dates back to the beginning of the Second Temple, and to some degree from the First Temple, but the First Temple's harder. Also, then you throw Nevuah into the pot and ask, how did people pass on halachas? Was it yes or Nevuah? You know, Nevuah, that also raises fascinating questions, which we'll continue with Be'ezrat Hashem next time when we talk about Nevuah specifically. All right, that's it, ladies. Have a lovely day.